Okay, everyone. Well, welcome today to Designers for Learning. Believe it or not, this is my fifth on-air event. I didn't know if we'd make it past our first one with Rick Schwier. And today I am very happy to be joined by Jay Wilson. He's a colleague of Rick Schwier's, one of my favorite people on the planet. And so he recommended I speak with Jay about what he's doing in his classes and with the instructional design work that he's doing in his courses and also some of the research he's doing. And so this is actually the first probably 5 minutes we've ever spoken. So this is really off the cuff today. So how are you doing today, Jay?
It's a beautiful day, a little frosty, but I'm really excited to have this opportunity today and see what I can remember about all the things that I claim to know about. So opportunities I think are really important to build all kinds of, you know, bridges and relationships and whatnot. So I'm really curious to see who's out there and if people have questions or what they what you think is valuable for me to share today. So I really welcome the opportunity today. It's looking forward to it.
Excellent. And just as a bit of logistics, we are simulcasting this on YouTube, so I'm not sure if people are seeing it there. It could be also in Google Plus. But I think most people are actually over at edtechtalk.com/live/D4L, the letter D, number 4, and L. And we happen to have a Titan pad there, which gives some of Jay's bio, as well as some links that I was able to pull off of his bio in terms of some of the research publications he's done. And then we also happen to have a chat where we've got quite a nice little conversation going. We'll see if I can follow the chat and talk at the same time. So setting the logistics aside, I think we're good from that standpoint. As you may have noticed, Jay, I think you said you caught some of our previous recordings. The whole purpose of me starting this webcast was really to get a sense for what people are doing in terms of creating authentic learning opportunities, which I'm quickly finding out is called by various terms depending on how you're coming at it. Some are referring to it as service learning, some are calling it applied learning, some are calling it performance-based, and I guess the general gist of the way we're coming at it and the way I've come at it on this webcast is kind of in contrast to what we're seeing in online learning specifically, post some videos, give students the opportunity to review it, and then rather than truly apply what they're learning, take a quiz or do some type of paper reflection or whatever. So actually immersing the students in actual learning opportunities. So with that kind of as the backdrop to the webcast in general, can you just share some of your perspectives on that and kind of touch on some of the research and the publications and some of the instructional design you're doing within your program?
Sure. In 5 minutes or less.
In 5 minutes or less. Go.
Yeah. another term to throw out is experiential learning. And that right now is a research project that I'm working on is throwing a whole new term into the mix. We call it authentic learning here, you know, PBL, all those other things. And I agree with you that, I don't know, I don't want to come across as this cynical guy right away, but I think you share my cynicism based on a couple of emails we exchanged yesterday, that it's not really that radical when you're following up something that may be a little bit different with a standard or a traditional way of assessment or a way of looking at it. So what I've tried to do is really take a step back and find out what can be the most useful learning experience, what has been my most useful learning experience, and then try to apply that in the courses that I'm teaching, and then that's finding its way into my research. So a lot of the, you know, those rules that happen at university, I'm a big rule breaker. I'm that forgiveness versus permission kind of person. And what I've tried to do is take people on a journey that not only allows them to get a good understanding, but then to apply that understanding. And I think that's an issue in all levels of education. But grad students in particular are really interested in going that much further and trying things and testing the waters. And the reason they come back is oftentimes they're disenchanted with their own experiences, or they're working in a system that they see is not designed very well and it's not put into practice if it's designed well. So they want to have that opportunity to particular name or title for this business. But when you get together with people who are doing it, then you share that common spirit around it. And you go, oh, well, that's what you call it. Well, this is what we call it. But it's the exact same thing. And, you know, the colleagues that I'm working with right now in this one research project, they work in soil sciences. So they work in our College of Agriculture. And they're doing things that you would assume would be part of what goes on with people working with soils and clays and land and growing things, but they're the, you know, almost the outsiders, because they're not doing things in a lab, in an enclosed building or whatnot. They're doing field courses. What I try to do as well is to get people out of, you know, bums and seats are good for money, but they're not good for learnings. So we get out of those seats, and I try to take people into environments that are as realistic as possible. And that's kind of, and I hope this, you know, I'm not much of a straight line thinker. So if you need to like cut me off or say, slow down and elaborate, I'll do that. But the approach we have to, you know, particularly our graduate program here, is to give people enough information and then give them something real to work on. And we do that in our instructional design courses. I teach program evaluation. It's the exact same thing. Video design, and you're thinking, well, how can that, you know, that's crazy. We, you know, how can people do that? But that's what we do. We have this cadence where people get comfortable, and then we throw them into a situation, and not throw them, but we scaffold them into a situation where they're able to apply the knowledge. And it's really an ownership issue a lot of times for the students. And when they take ownership of it and they go, well, I know enough to know when to ask for help. I know enough to know if I'm being successful. I know enough to ask a teammate or a client, you know, is this okay? Because I'm still learning. I'm not an expert yet, and I really struggle with the term expert. But does it give me enough knowledge to progress through? And I know that I'm going to get to the end eventually, and whatever becomes of me or my project at the end will be okay, and things will be all right. So that's part of the, I guess, kind of the philosophical approach. Mm-hmm. This whole notion of what we do here. And, is there anything? Yeah, ask me a question about something I said and all.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I've got a bunch. Yeah. I'll get them all out at once. But yeah, a couple of things that I did want to touch on is kind of the instructional design of this. I know you're teaching instructional design students, mm-hmm. so we're kind of, you know, mixing the students with how you're structuring the whole thing. But you've touched on a couple things that have come up in prior discussions I've had with folks, that this is a much messier way. I guess it's a very inelegant way to say it, but it's just a messier way to teach, right? That you're throwing people into authentic situations that you can't control everything that happens to their experience. And so, as you mentioned, you're there to scaffold them. And so what I've been asking most of my guests, or all my guests, is what is your approach to make it add a little more structure to that messiness, so that there is a safety net for people when they need it, yet at the same time you're giving them enough rope to actually learn from the experience and kind of take from that messiness and get gain from it as well?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm a big fan of messiness. And looking around my office, you wouldn't know that because it's clean, surprisingly clean for the end of the term. But I guess if you've ever watched the show Aladdin, you ever watched the movie Aladdin?
Oh, ages ago, but yeah. Okay.
When he's on the flying carpet and he reaches out his hand and he says, "Do you trust me?" Uh-huh. And I use that line all the time. I'm sure I owe Disney $1 million as a result of it. But it really does come down to building that trust, because if you make it less messy, it's really going to impact the depth of the learning and the ability for people to go, "Whew, I made it through. It wasn't pretty. I've got, you know, bruises and scars, but I really learned a lot, and I can speak to a particular body of content now with the knowledge that I've been through it, I've struggled, I've learned through it." And so I hesitate to get away from the messiness. There will be times, and rope is good, because, you know, you want to let out a bit, but you also don't want people to have enough to hang themselves. So sometimes I do pull in the rope, and people will generally feel comfortable enough with me to come and sit in my office and say, "Here's where I am, Jay. It's been a real struggle for me. I just need some guidance." Mm-hmm. But rarely does anyone give up. Rarely does anyone reach a point where they doubt their abilities to a level that they're saying, you know, "I have to start from scratch," or "I need you to step in and speak to the client for me because I'm not I'm not comfortable with it. I think on an undergrad level that would happen.
Mm-hmm.
I think the messiness would cause people grief. And I have pretty messy undergrad classes as well, but not to the same contact with clients. And because they are primarily teachers, not instructional designers, they're focused on a very specific audience and there are fewer variables.
Mm-hmm.
But I am hesitant to put a rigid structure in. I mean, we all have the scholars and that body of knowledge that what we do is built upon, and you never want to turn your back on that. But when it comes down to doing instructional design, so much of it is that art that you develop. And it's like being a painter. You have to paint 1,000 really bad, you know, dandelion paintings before you can do your irises or whatever you consider your masterpiece. So there's a really long answer to the messiness question, but I, again, that's something that I really think draws people in to the learning experience. They don't want that structure. They want to be challenged by, you know, if you've heard the term wicked problems before, I love that, that whole notion that it's not just a problem, but it's a wicked problem, and people can get really fired up about attacking those things because they know it's going to be a battle throughout.
Yeah, I in a consulting class I'm teaching this semester, I talk about the pain points, and that's what you get paid to do in the real world, is to solve painful problems for people. And so if it's not that painful, people aren't going to give you much opportunity. You're not going to get much compensation ultimately in the real world. And so you kind of embrace the pain and say that you're, you know, that's what you're there to help help people work through. And I did put a link in the chat room to a couple of your papers that fortunately are open access and folks are able to open. And I noticed in one of them you kind of frame your paper around these five pillars, and I think I've written them down, but kind of tagging along to what you've already mentioned, that they're problem-based or project-based, that there's a degree of project management built in, as we mentioned before, the scaffolding. Then there are a couple of things that you didn't mention yet, but this whole idea of social agency, which I think in your projects, what you're trying to do for a couple of reasons, some may be pragmatic, you're working from the most part with nonprofits or those with a social mission because, like I said, from a practical standpoint, you can't get in a situation where you're competing with those in your area. I think that was referenced in your paper. But what else do you think comes about from that idea of the social agency and that you're doing this kind of for a greater good or a bigger thing beyond just the classroom experience?
Well, I think a lot of that has to do with me as a person. And I know that the other people I work with share a similar approach to it. We're kind of good old boys or good old folks around here.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're in touch with reality. You know, we have families and children, and we have struggles in our day-to-day lives that really, you know, don't allow us to pretend that we are in any way, shape, or form changing the world with, you know, with spewing forth and lectures and whatnot. So we've made it a point to, and myself in particular, to find opportunities to have people, when they design something, not just say, hey, that was a great instructional intervention or tool or process, but I've made an impact on people's lives. I've had that opportunity to see or hear about in the community what's going on, and as a result of it, I personally feel good, and I know that I'm not just doing a project to fulfill a goal and go a little bit further than maybe I would in a traditional course. So I think that that's where it's kind of started from. And it's kind of, you know, there are murky waters, and everyone, you know, talks a good talk about, yes, we're helping people here, but there, you know, there's sometimes little evidence to prove that what you're doing actually has that outcome. We're running our first ever summer institute, you know, based on research here this summer, and so we're trying to give examples of what we've done in our classes. And I went back to some of the work that my students had done. One example is we worked with the Council on Aging in Saskatoon. So we've got this wonderful nonprofit organization that works with seniors and people in the later stages of their wonderful lives, and really lots of information, lots of good resources, but unable to connect with those people. And these are things, you know, like Meals on Wheels and just daily life, in addition to getting them some other skills that they might need to know, you know, helping people who who are now, you know, have been a couple for 90 years or 60 years, and now you're what, you know, those kinds of things that really impact people's lives. And when we were done that project, that was, I think, 4 years ago, the people were just over the moon. They were so excited, you know, mm-hmm. there were hugs and tears and everything. And to go back to that, they're still using that resource that we created. We also empowered them by showing them how they could update and modify their own website. We talked about the design principles behind it. And so we shared with them a whole other avenue. But to go back and to see that legacy that's come about, we've really made some positive change. We work with our First Nations community here at the University of Saskatchewan. It's a very important thing. So one of my upcoming projects is building resources for classroom teachers that don't have a background around nations. And we're looking in our province, you know, in 20 years at a 50% First Nations school population. And that's in every school in our province. We need to do a better job to help those people. I mean, that, in my mind, those kinds of opportunities really go beyond and kind of transcend the learning experience for people. And you know, it's pretty emotional. And you talk to people who you haven't seen in a few years, former students, and they'll remember those. You know, they don't always remember their ERADS classes.
Mm-hmm,
you
know, right.
But they'll remember, you know, that person made us cinnamon buns, and then we sat around and we talked, you know, those kinds of personal connections and the, you know, the pats on the backs and the tears of joy kind of thing. So that's kind of how that fits in from a social perspective or social.
I couldn't agree more. And in my consulting class, I gave the students kind of getting back to the logistics of how I ran mine and kind of looking into how other people are doing theirs. So this semester, I had the students go out and they could do something within their workplace or a place they volunteer, their church, whatever it may be. Mm-hmm. And some did go down the volunteering route with a nonprofit in their community. I teach mine all at a distance and online, which is another component I'd like to talk to you about. So it sounds like in your case, you were dealing with this a scenario where you had students face-to-face or at least in some local where they could come to meet the people they were working with. Have you attempted to do this at a distance where people are not local and so they're, you know, not able to come and have face-to-face interactions with the people, the clients they're working with?
Well, in that particular course, we did have some people at a distance and as you would expect, because we work in teams as opposed to working with individuals, at least in this culminative class, we had them do less direct work with the client, but they were still, you know, this, in the same way that we're connecting here, they would use Skype and they would phone and have connections that way. I guess the other thing is that because I want people to make an impact in their community, if I am working with students at a distance, then I ask them to find someone local that they can work with. And I do think that interface is really important. So that, you know, the connection with me is maybe less important than their ability to easily and often face-to-face have a connection with the people that they're working with. And you know what it's like to go through a design problem. You want to, you know, look around the room and find those nonverbal cues of the things mm-hmm. that aren't written in paper or, you know, silly things. How clean is a location? You know, what do people really care about what's going on? And so I think it is really important to say if you're going to take, you know, this particular class from me, and I'm, you know, nothing specific, but what I want you to do is find a place where you can go and you can really engage with the experience. And I know it's really tough to do design work at a distance where you would do a contract and, you know, and have that distance. But I think that if you can work at chipping away at that and make those connections, I think it's much more successful.
And that's something I talked to several of my prior guests, again, kind of this whole logistics of how you set the relationship up and who is considered the, and I'm putting in air quotes here, the account manager. Clearly, if it's something that you're doing in a face-to-face environment, you as the instructor have gone out and set up the relationship, you kind of take on a little bit of that role and try to pass it off to the students from the project management aspect. But from what you're describing in this last scenario, which kind of mirrors what I'm doing, I'm really putting the whole responsibility in the hands of the student to go find it, develop the relationship from the outset. I'm more of a guide on the side to help when I start seeing things getting a little weird. For example, we had one student who was halfway through the semester and his client was MIA and, you know, was gone. And so we had to kind of scramble and take care of things that were very much out of his control and really out of my control. And so I noticed in some of the the one article at least, it appeared you were taking the entire class through a project, or at least in smaller groups versus individual projects. Are there any pros and cons to having it be an individual experience versus a group-based project, or is it just kind of a matter of how things are structured in the class that semester?
Well, the weird thing is I do it differently in all my classes. And I've had this discussion before. I've done some work, not some work, but some research with the University of Iowa, and especially around program evaluation, where actually in their instructional design course, they let the students decide, and here at the University of Saskatchewan, we pick for the students. And then in my program evaluation, they would do the memorandum of understanding, and then I say, yeah, go find a client, and we'll figure out if it's suitable. So I think there are certainly pros and cons to both of them. The advantage of choosing your own client and working independently, oftentimes you already have a relationship, and so you feel comfortable with that part of it. So you're not establishing a relationship and trying to learn at the same time, which for people is, you know, it's pretty stressful. For grad students who have come into the program as experts or superintendents or, you know, lead teachers where they're, you know, they're the top of the hill, and then all of a sudden they go back down a few cliffs. Mm-hmm. So I think that's really stressful for them. The advantages of choosing a client is that you can really screen them for the issues that you raise around having people go MIA, mm-hmm. which is oftentimes the most frustrating part. Because we work in an artificial environment in some sense, that, you know, when the term is over, the project should be over.
Yeah, now, that's huge, right? You find a problem that can be solved within, really, by the time you get the class going, that it can be solved in like 12 weeks.
You know, yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
And it's really, I think that's the advantage of having that memorandum of understanding. Like this course that we do, the advanced instructional design, starts in the second term. So in the summertime, we're already negotiating before we even know how many students are in and who the students are and whatnot. So we can lay down those things and say, all right, I know the university says we're not supposed to start the class, but yeah, we started in advance. Let's have our first meeting before Christmas instead of after, so you can start connecting with the other people on your team, up with some ideas, being aware. So I think that advantage of having a plan in advance, you can never put out all the fires, but you can certainly know which direction you're going to spray the water, and then see where it's going to go. The other thing is that some clients really need to be informed about the process, mm-hmm. and they don't know what it's like to work with an agency, an organization. Program evaluation is a fine example. You know, they're not sure what their job is. And so it's really important sometimes to educate those people. And if we know in advance, you know, who they are and what they're going to do or what they don't know, we can take the time to educate them and say, well, this is what we want from you, and we're not going to do this for you, but we'll provide you the information that will allow you to do that. And we really need you to meet 4 times. Is that, you know, does that work? Most times, because we are working specifically with nonprofit organizations, they're really willing to be flexible because mm-hmm. they're getting, you know, $60,000 of pro bono ID work, and they're like, right, oh, yeah, this is awesome, you know, whatever you want. But a lot of times in those organizations, there's one paid executive director and maybe some admin support, so they're already running off their feet as well, and so we want to bring them into the process but not burden them with too many things that, mm-hmm. that happen.
Yeah, that it's we spend most of our synchronous time in my classes talking through what you're saying here, and some of the resistance, for example, as you're saying, when there's just, you know, a one-man shop that you're assisting, mm-hmm. and you can't get them on the phone. You know, is that really are they just busy? One, for example, one guy's working in a restaurant and he's working with the owner of the restaurant, and so the guy's just busy. He's just putting out meals every night, so it has nothing to do with resistance. But in other mm-hmm. cases, it's just that's kind of part of the skill set that they're developing is as you're working as a consultant in instructional design and you're not getting answers, you're trying to decipher, is this resistance I'm getting to my suggestions and it's kind of a change management issue, or is it just the guy's been busy? So it's kind of hard for me to tell, again, being so far removed from the relationship, but yeah.
Yeah, and it does draw attention to the importance of interpersonal skills when you're doing any kind of a project. And if you come in you really have to be sensitive to people's needs. So, you know, if the lunch rush is on, for example, yeah. stay away from the restaurant unless you're prepared to put an apron on and bust some dishes.
Exactly.
Or, you know, no one owes you anything. And yeah. so when you come in and you're like, well, we're going to do this and that, you know, that can really turn a client off and it can really, you know, derail a project or set it back considerably, especially if you've done a lot of work to build those initial relationships. Yeah. You really want to, you know, instill in your students the importance of you're here to help, you're here to listen first and foremost, and you're here to learn. And, you know, what you can offer people at the end hopefully will benefit their organization. But it's, you know, you do have those people that kick in the front door with guns blazing, and it's yeah. really
and it, counterproductive. You know, we're kind of at the stage of the semester where they've done their analysis and now they're getting to the stage of making recommendations. And already you can just they're getting that. So they're very frustrated when they feel that their recommendations aren't being taken seriously. And I don't think they're really going to implement what I'm telling them to do. And it's like, well, again, this is a life lesson. You know, the whole you can lead a horse to water, but you cannot make him drink. So then you then start using some of the adoption of innovation skills and techniques that you're mm-hmm. trying to teach. And kind of getting back to our original minutes we were talking here, this is the kind of thing that I don't think can be taught by reading about other people doing it. I think you have to do it. I could give the best lecture and record it and have quizzes afterwards telling people about resistance and telling people about change management and how you, you communicate new ideas and roll things out. Until you actually try it, I really don't know how you can learn it. And again, it gets to the difference between kind of a recall versus application, getting back to, you know, basic Blooms. But And I don't know, from a logistics standpoint, Peggy's mentioning some techniques that were mentioned in prior webcasts. In terms of the management, it's an extremely time-consuming way to teach and to instruct because it's, in some respects, you're herding cats. You've got everybody out doing a bunch of projects, and once a week we try to get everybody together and talk through some kind of the common things people are facing, and then having a series of one-to-one meetings, which, again, is so beyond the scope of what you typically do in an online class.
That, yeah.
You know, it's just a new level of burden on the instructor. And so a couple things I wanted to touch on, and I do as well, and I've heard other people do, memorandum of understanding or agreement, really in two components. In my course, for example, I have the students do one with me early in the semester where they lay out their plan, especially if, particularly this one where they're finding their own client, because I need to kind of pre-qualify what it is they're trying to do. Then once that's established, then have some type of memorandum of understanding with the client, which gets into kind of a more traditional consulting client contract. And they get very squeamish at the word contract, so we're now calling mm-hmm. it memorandum of agreement. I don't know why. They're going to be sued or something if yeah. it's under a contract. But what are some of the things, you touched on some of them, do you have that component where there's an agreement with the student that you have and then also agreement that the student carries out with their client, or is it just kind of one thing? And what are the different components of those agreements?
Well, I just have a standard, this is what I will do and this is what, and the memorandum of understanding for the Advanced Instructional Design course is the group with me as kind of the grown-up. Mm-hmm. But they, you know, they choose a project manager or someone that will lead, and so I'll kind of be in the background on that. And then for program evaluation or video design or multimedia design, it's really up to them as an individual to sign off with whoever has that authority for the organization that they're working with. So I guess in both instances or all instances, it's a one shot deal. We certainly sit down and negotiate. We have a meeting, we talk about, you know, roles and responsibilities and try to establish that environment of openness and communication right off the bat. And what it does, in my mind, is it makes the student realize that they're front and center.
Mm-hmm.
And so, there is kind of an unwritten agreement with me as your instructor that we're going to do this and here's the syllabus and here's our course objectives and this is where we want to go. But that's almost secondary to this pledge that you've made to the client to do your best. Now, we're not, you know, sometimes their best is junk, right? We know that.
And
so,
yeah.
So we tell the client.
No, not my students. You're
okay.
talking about
okay. Only my students, and because of me, because I'm such a rotten, rotten teacher. But sometimes they'll miss the boat, or it won't quite fit the way people envisioned it. So we make sure we temper people's expectations and say, you know, this is a student project. We've never really had, and when I use the term "jack," we've never really had anything that's been a flop, right? It's mm-hmm. always met, you know, at least a minimal and an acceptable level of client need. But we really want people to know that they're going into it, and the responsibility they have is not necessarily to me, and it's certainly not to a grade or mm-hmm. anything along those lines. It's to the project, and mm-hmm. the person that represents the project, their client or the stakeholders, are really the key audience that they need to keep happy. So that's why, for me personally, I don't have, you know, a different agreement. I just have that one sign-off sheet. And, you know, from a practical point of view, I make sure that through the discussions and the pre-work, if there's pre-work that's done, that we find out who the person with the hammer really mm-hmm. is. And you don't want to be going to board meetings and saying, oh, well, I'd like all 96 of you to just share your thoughts with me because you come to a meeting 1 hour every 6 months, and so you deserve the floor, you know, all those kinds of things, and I'm sure you do the same thing in your courses. But you need to find that one person who, when you sign, you take care of the battles on your end if there are issues and implementation and whatnot, but you and I are going to have this relationship as professionals. I, the program manager, you as the person who speaks for your organization and has the power to say, yes, we like the prototype, we're going to move on to implementation, or we're going to move on to this next phase.
Yeah, and I think you're hitting on a couple things. The reason I have the two distinct is one is kind of my how I'm going to evaluate or assess the student at the end of the semester. Okay. So they're giving me some sense of what project they're completing, so I have an idea of, you know, what am I going to be looking at, an instructional design document? Are you doing some type of assessment? Are you doing an evaluation? What are you doing? And then as you get to the points you're making in terms of expectations of what the relationship's going to look like with the client. So who is your client? That's kind of one of the first things.
Yeah.
And then also what you need from them in order to be able to get things done. So, for example, if you're doing some type of analysis, you're going to need access to people, documents, whatever it might be. And so kind of getting them in from an learning to be an instructional designer, that this is what you need to learn how to do, that you have to be very specific in what your needs are in order for you to fulfill your requirements and obligations. And again, getting back to what we talked at the beginning, these are hard things to know about until you've actually done it. And I'm really noticing the students, they're at the point in the semester saying, say, you know what, my client really isn't living up. They're not really giving me the access that they told me they're going to get. And that's why I said, well, you know, that's why we think about that at the beginning. And we spend all this time up front thinking about what do you need to be able to do your job. And they're also having the opportunities now to kind of call their client on it, saying, if we want to stick to the time frame we've discussed, if we want to stick to the deliverables we've discussed, then do a little bit of pushback and get the access that that they've been promised at the beginning. So that's kind of why I do the two separate ones. And also then, this isn't, and Peggy was asking, why do I call them clients? This is the title of the course is Consulting Skills for Instructional okay. Designers. So whether you're an internal consultant at a company or if you're an external freelancer, that's why I'm turning. Is that what you call? Did you call the, yep. the student product clients as well?
Yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely. And I'm not sure if Rick shared our mantra with you, but it's on time, under budget, and beyond expectations. And so that's, you know, whenever we get together, we can, you know, we don't get in a circle, but that, you know, by the end of the term, people are, you know, okay, what are we doing? And so it's kind of a rallying point as well, and it just, you know, keeps things focused. Now, the fact that we do things for free means that we're always under budget.
Right.
So that one's a given, but the, you know, exceeding expectations is really important, and exceeding your own expectations as well as those of the client. And I think people sometimes focus on, we're just trying to, you know, make them happy, but it's really, you know, when they go in, a lot of times, because they're teachers or curriculum designers, they've done all kinds of creation of instruction and lessons and materials and whatnot, but they've never understood it from a, you know, from an instructional design perspective. And I think when they get into the final project, they really start, you know, things start to fall together, and their expectations are always exceeded. It's, you know, those classes are, again, the ones that they look back on most favorably when they're finished their program as a result. And they can say, yeah, I did work with a real client, and there were some struggles, but you know, when everything was said and done, everyone came out of it relatively unscathed and certainly pleased with what happened.
And that's another thing I forgot to mention. As you're saying, we're not charging our clients. However, as kind of a skill development, I do ask the students to prepare a budget, and it's all time, and it's not expense. Well, expense if they think ultimately the client will go out and maybe purchase something. But for the most part, it's the time of the student, and it's for a couple of reasons. First of all, we all completely under budget how much time it's going to take to do anything. And so I ask them at the beginning of the semester, lay out all the activities you think you're going to need to do, how much time it's going to take you. The end of the semester, or throughout the semester, I have them maintain a project management blog. Where they go in each week, I ask something simple, a couple paragraphs, what you did, what you still need to do, how many hours things are taking, and then at the end of the semester, tally all those hours and compare it to your estimate. Mm-hmm. And then I've also asked them to go out on various websites, figure out what an instructional designer can make in their area if you were doing this on a freelance basis, realize that this is your whole salary, your benefits and everything. And it's really interesting. It's amazing how people are just don't get that part of it, especially if you're coming from a situation where you're not a freelancer, you're just getting a paycheck. So I had some students budgeting $20 an hour, and I'm like, well, that's $40,000 a year. Some were budgeting $80 an hour. I was like, well, more power to you. You know,
yeah,
you can make $160,000 a year right out of college, you know. Very happy for you.
Hire me when you're done, yeah.
That's another component that I think, as far as the application of what we're doing, I'm not sure we take it to that next level and say, what are we worth and what's our time worth and how long does it do things take? Mm-hmm. And again, I don't know how you teach these things until you embed it in something authentic.
So. Yeah, and I do the same thing. I always, for my courses, I always have them do a preliminary budget. So we just wrapped up the introductory program evaluation course, and I wanted them to, you know, determine how much time based on the plan that they'd laid out that would take them at a reasonable rate. And some of the interesting things that came up were, you know, while I'm a teacher, I do this for free. You know, And I push back on that, and I say, well, how do you have, you know, unfortunately, the way you assign value to something is to assign a dollar figure to it. So if you're going to do this for your school division, I want you to be able to take this to your director when you're done and say, this is what happened. So value me because of what I have done, not just because I'm a teacher and I love my school and my division and everything and I'll do all kinds of things for free, but give it a value, even if it makes you feel intrinsically more valued, if you're not externally more valued. But they're always really surprised, and we had a real debate last Saturday on what is the rate that I choose. And some people are like, well, yeah, I'm really cheap. I only do $25 an hour. And some people were, you know, $80 an hour. Yeah. Some people would take, you know, was a sub day, $220 a day for a sub. So if I'm going to get a sub, that's what I need to be paid to be out of my classroom for these, you know, period of time. But it was always under, the estimate's always under. They always undervalue or underestimate how much time it's going to take and how much worth the work that they're doing has. And it's at the end of the big projects when they've done, like you say, when they've kept a running total at the end and we add it all up, then they go, wow, that's insane, you know. And then they say,
joke.
Can I do this as a profession now?
Exactly. My joke is I've got a Burger King across the street where I live in Chicago, and I know there's some projects I do I could make more if I worked over at Burger King. And I tell them this, that, you know, if you're not conscious when you're bidding for a project, if you're not conscious as you're doing the work, you may as well go work across the street at McDonald's or Burger King, because, you know, it's something, as you're saying, you underestimate. And then I also think another skill, and I do want to talk to you about this. I think there's a paper that you'd written as far as like this, I think you called it like the hidden skills or the hidden things, the activities that instructional designers do. I don't think as a profession we're very good at teaching our students the cost benefit. And so there's a cost to the problem in not fixing whatever it is you're working on. And then and then in turn, the benefit of fixing it, and then the cost associated with fixing it, and kind of comparing the two. And so as you're saying, the one student said, well, I'm paid anyway, or, you know, I'm a teacher, so I don't, you know, not realizing, well, there is a cost to someone of paying your salary, and that you could be doing a whole bunch of different things. And so we've agree that this is a problem we need to tackle, and the cost of, or the benefit of fixing it is X, and then the cost of your time to do it is Y, and hopefully, you know, the benefit outweighs the cost. And those are types of things that I don't think I never had in my master's or PhD program presented to me. It was in my MBA program where you didn't make a strategic business decision unless you thought about those things. And those are just very foreign concepts, in my opinion, in the instructional design world.
Yeah, and I think it's really hard for us to teach that to people. And I'm certainly, you know, of the mindset things need to get done, so you do the work, right?
Yeah.
And I don't know. I'm certainly not there yet, and it's really hard to convince at least the students that I work with. But that being said, I've had a number of people go through the program as one thing, come out as something completely different, and then move into that as a profession, and then they realize, wow, you know, this is something that I can do. And it speaks to that professionalism of design and evaluation and not just being doing favors for people, but working as someone who is valued for the skills that they have beyond the, you know, what's traditionally recognized. And for me, that's been one of the great things to come out of this, is that people who, yeah, that looks like a good elective, and then they get sucked in, and now they're working as evaluators or instructional designers in business and industry. So they're not even in education anymore. They've come in as classroom teachers, and they've really been successful through their own hard work and efforts, and have achieved levels of success that they didn't know existed in areas they didn't know existed. And that's really gratifying for me personally.
Yeah. And it comes up, we have a lot of students doing internal projects at work, so they're taking on a role as an internal consultant. Well, every manager is faced with a whole bunch of different projects they could undertake and assign their staff to. And so that's kind of part of the skill set that I'm helping them develop. If you're pitching an idea to your boss, you know, you kind of have to step back and say, what's in it for the organization? What's in it for my boss? They can assign me to X, Y, and Z. I'm making a case for X. And again, getting back to, because I think it'll provide this benefit to our organization and my time is worth whatever. So anyway, kind of to your, the as I mentioned, your article. So what, I can't recall off the top of my head, what was that one that you had written?
Is it on the...
I think it's Unconventional Roles and Activities Identified by Instructional Designers. So is that kind of touching on that? That one I wasn't able to access when I clicked on it.
Yeah, that's the one... trying to think of where it is. I just went to your link. I can't find it. I'm so organized today. It's probably messy. But yeah, it is... what we did with that research is we worked with people who are instructional designers who had previously been in our program, which is, you know, convenience. But we really found out that they were learning that it's not about, as you say, what happens in the textbook. It's, you know, I had no idea that I was going to have to work in some form of crisis management in an organization.
Yeah.
And, the, you know, their disdain for SMEs just grows and grows, you know, and we tried to instill that in them when we met with them. The notion that I don't want to be a trainer, but a lot of times you may... You know, it's so important that particular process that you put in place get put into place that you end up being a trainer and you have to lead, you know, and I had no idea I was going to do that, or I had no idea that I had to really learn all this background information about an organization because they didn't really know about their own organization. So all of those different skills that you know, just kind of develop over time, and they're certainly not skills that people are always, you know, warm to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I got into this position because I wanted to solve problems, and instead what I'm doing is, you know, I'm waiting for people who are always late for meetings, and, you know, I'm like you say, I'm herding cats, and really that's, you know, you have to just stop and take a deep cleansing breath, right? Into your nose, out to your mouth, it's going to be okay. and I don't know that we really prepare people for the messiness, for that lack of uncertainty that's so inherent in the profession.
I joke with the students when I'm trying to get them signed on, because this is a different concept, let's face it. This is not how 99.9% of classes are run. So you do have to do a tad bit of selling, at least I find, in the first couple weeks to go, this is worth it, people, stick with me. It's going to be more work, but it's worth it. And I kind of joke that don't be afraid of the the skill sets, because you learn most of them in high school, how to get along with people, how to, you know, be nice to the people that aren't nice to you and get people to do things and whatever. And so it's not necessarily that these are skills that you don't know about. It's just more reframing them and figuring out a way to use them as you're trying to push forward with your project that you're working on. So
I'm a big fan of slogans and bumper stickers and phrases and whatnot. And I was interviewing a gal. She was a computer trainer or something like that in Scotland. And the great advice that I got from her that I use all the time is, when you come up against an issue that you're not sure about, treat it like a teenager would.
Absolutely. So, you know,
with a lack of caution, or, you know, and sometimes that's, you know, it's not appropriate to advise people, but if there are folks that are being really tentative, I say treat it like a teenager would. You know, do teenagers read the manual? Do they look at instructions? Do they, you know, and I want people to be aware of what's going on. So I don't want them to be oblivious to the signs and the cues that are around them, but I don't want them to let, you know, that Texas gate get in the way. I want them to engage in a project, and you're going to make mistakes and it's going to be messy. But if you, if you're looking at, you know, the ADDIE model or something like that as your guide, you're in big trouble.
And that's what, when I talk about the high school thing, I said, I'm not sure if anyone in the class has changed schools when they were in high school, but almost think about it like you're all of a sudden, you're in 10th grade and you're in a new school, and what do you need to do to survive? And in many ways, those are the same skills that you need to be able to do your job. So
that's great advice.
So here's my bigger picture of what, I'm not sure if you've had any opportunity to look at kind of the background of this. Ultimately, what I'd love to be able to create in some way, shape, or form, and that's to be debated, is to take these concepts we're talking about here and think of a way to do this outside of just your institution. So, for example, create some type of pro bono network. So I think it'd be really cool if, like, a student in your program and a student in my program or whatever worked on a project together. And I think these would be bigger scale things beyond just a 16-week semester, maybe internships or things like that. Or it may just be professionals who want to try out new skills and tackle something they haven't done before and use a pro bono opportunity to do it. What do you think of some of the pros and cons of doing that, incorporating people from outside of, you know, a core institution, and also layering in this idea of professionals coming in as either mentors or maybe even members of the project team who, again, as I said, are just trying to develop new skills and try something they've never done before?
Well, of course I'd love it. Because that's what, you know, I think, again, I know this is being recorded, but once we get out of the building.
It is being recorded. I'm sorry.
Once we get out of the building, that's when the real learning starts.
Sorry.
Which does nothing for
You're
job
fired.
Security.
No, just kidding.
Right? Yeah, that's all right. So I think that those are wonderful opportunities. And every time you have a chance to interact with someone who is either doing the exact same thing as you, or at least that's what you think, you learn from them. Mm-hmm. When you work with people who are doing something completely different, then you learn from them as well, provided you have an open mind and your intentions are good. And so I think it would be suited for some students, but not for others. Mm-hmm. Some people come to higher education to get a raise, plain and simple.
Right.
And if they, you know, they learn a bit, that's a bonus. Other people are looking to really explore and dig into education and learning and in ways that they've heard about or thought about, but never had the opportunity to. So I would say, on a small scale, I think this would be fantastic. I think it would be great. I think getting to go to Chicago on a regular basis for me would certainly be a reason to, because it's one of my favorite cities. But the issue that I have is the client issue. Mm-hmm. And whenever you work with an outside client, especially business and industry people, their rules are different, their days are different, their goals are different. And I know that in my own experience and those with colleagues that I've worked with on campus here, sometimes these people are so busy and you need to be ready to use that hour or day or whatever time they give you to the full extent, and they may never be prepared for a meeting. Mm-hmm. They may be there and that's about it. And so I think it would be certainly working with clients. I guess the nonprofit clients are often better for this because they're more dedicated to a project. But if you have someone who's already managing a bunch of other things, and you talked about that already, is they're really busy and they don't value things in the same way we would or the same way the students would. So I think you'd have to really choose the people wisely. And you may not start right at the top, but you may have those people that, that get things done and make things happen. And what that shows the students is the, you know, how effective people work. Mm-hmm. Because we know a lot of people in management, the reason they're good managers is because they hire the right people. And they may have lots of clout and they may have the authority, but they may not have the skill set or the knowledge to get things done. So I would say for students, it's a great opportunity. I think for institutions to collaborate, I think that's so important that we don't say, this is my university and I only, you know, work to where the boundaries of the university are, especially with all the technologies we have. I mean, today is a perfect example of that. But I think it would really come down to project and client selection to ultimately be successful, especially if someone was putting a whole year into it. Mm-hmm. You know, wow, Christmas time, this thing's fallen apart. You've given up half your year. You have a leave from your school for a year, and now we've got 6 months to try to figure out how we can salvage this. So,
right. And that's kind of
thoughts.
Everything you've mentioned, so I've talked to different people. I've talked to the taprootfoundation.org. I'm not sure if you've, they're a pro bono network, and they manage it very much like as though they're a consulting firm working with HR or finance issues or whatever it may be, and then they go and hire people to do pro bono work, and so they manage it very differently. So there are definitely people out there doing it, and so when I spoke with them, many of the things you're mentioning came up, where we're coming at it trying to provide opportunities for two different constituents. You've got the students who need experience, and then you have the nonprofit, and so they don't care about necessarily what the people on the pro bono side get out of the experience. They're more interested in delivering on what they commit to on the client side to the nonprofit. So that was kind of a red flag, she said right there, that you've got to kind of serve two masters, if you will, that you've got to make sure everybody on the supply side and the demand side are getting what they need out of the relationship. So that's a challenge right there. And then also the issues of everything you've mentioned, from account management, who's really driving the relationship and who's making sure things are getting done. I know we're running out of time now, but a lot of this comes back to a project that came to my attention last summer, where a nonprofit in our area wanted to take some of the face-to-face training they're doing and moving it online. Mm-hmm. And so I pitched this idea, where it was very much a spark of an idea, saying, well, what if I could go out and pull a bunch of students? I'll go out to some listservs that I'm familiar with and get some students to do some, you know, free work for you. And they were like, maybe. They were real squeamish about it. For one thing, they weren't going to be local. They were going to be across North America at that point. So that made them squeamish. And then just the idea of, as you're saying, students doing the work. It's kind of hit or miss on what the outcome may be. On the supply side, I just made a couple inquiries. I was flooded with resumes where people were like, please, you know, I need an internship for the fall semester. I need to get experience in this and that. And I had no trouble on the student side. But then at that point also, I didn't want to take on the role necessarily as the account manager. I hadn't thought through some of the logistics of being the account manager. Yeah. So, you know, it's just a spark of an idea, and this is kind of where we're starting with these webcasts, getting people's perspectives and what they're doing. And getting back to this whole idea of logistics, how do you actually manage these experiences for people so it's beneficial to the students as well as the organizations you're working with. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because ultimately you do, you know, although you don't use it, you do have the hammer, you know, grades and badge and not that you ever have, but like you say, if you're managing people on a broader scale that maybe aren't as connected with the host or home institution, then, yeah, it can get kind of messy.
Yeah. Well, one thing I was thinking about, too, is figuring out a way to get a roster of maybe 3, 4, 5 nonprofits that would like to play along in some fashion and just say, you know, that we don't know what's going to happen. We've never tried it. And then actually almost put like a request for proposal, like so where they would outline what they're looking for in general terms, and then have students, either students as individuals or as teams, kind of bid on the project and say, well, if I were to tackle this, this is what I would do, and then let them run with it and run with the relationship versus me kind of helping manage the project, which would then kind of push it back in some respects to the classroom or to that main institution. And that may be a way to get through some of those their bigger picture logistics that I'm trying to keep clear of. So.
Well, and that makes sense, because if you have a client that has multiple programs, then they become familiar with the process. And it's almost like your students are on retainer, and they know what to expect, and you've got those logistics looked after, and they can go back year after year and say, okay. Because a lot of those smaller groups are running, I don't know how they do it, but they run so many different types of programs that there's always opportunity.
I noticed ASTD, which is a big professional organization, they actually have a community outreach where they work with, for example, United Way. Mm-hmm. And so that might be an opportunity as well, partner up with something like that where they already have an infrastructure in place and we would just be supply, just some worker bees helping out.
Oh, yeah, and United Way was one of the first organizations globally to look at the importance of program evaluation. And so, you know, from that perspective, that's one of the areas I teach. They are already on board. They've got processes. They want people to do those because it's mandated, mm-hmm. and it's really important to, I guess not important. It's fortunate to have clients that are already educated about that process.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I mean, we're running up on our hour, and I just really appreciate your time. And it's like kind of a closing question to you. Is there anyone else that you think I should talk to, or that's interested in this area that may want to spend an hour talking about it?
I'll have to think about that.
There aren't many, right?
Well, you're right. I mean, there are a lot of people that don't value this whole notion of doing things differently. And you know, we do research, but sometimes, you know, research takes precedence over teaching for people. And I think we've got a good mix here in our organization. So I'm gonna pass on that one. I'm gonna cop out, but I'm gonna think about it and see who I can send in your direction.
That's great. That's
but
great.
I'd certainly really welcome this opportunity today. I think it was great to you know, just sit and talk with people who share similar ideas about the world and.
Excellent. I agree. Couldn't agree more. Well, thank you so much. And thanks to everybody who hung in there. And we'll get the recording posted. So it'll be an audio podcast, or you can watch our lovely faces. On
oh,
the
my
video.
Gosh.
So, well, thanks very much, Jay. Have a great week.
You too, Jennifer. Thanks so much.
Talk to you later. Bye-bye. Yeah.